This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're broadcasting live from the National Mall, where workers are busy setting up tents, stages, and chairs to prepare for tomorrow's opening of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian. A lot of effort and struggle went into this new project, from raising the money to getting the complex architecture of the building's undulating wind and water-carved look just right, to the politics of where artifacts belong and how they should be treated. You may be surprised to hear that the name of the museum came without struggle. In 1989, Congress passed legislation to establish the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. It's the name for Native peoples used by the U.S. Census. But ask American Indians how they identify themselves, and you'll get a lot of different answers. Native American, First Nation, Indigenous, Aboriginal, often they will start with the name of their tribe or nation: Cherokee, Hopi, Oneida, Odawa, Mohawk, or Pequot. And the variations of identity don't stop there. Are you full-blooded or mixed? Are you res or urban? Can you speak the language, know the ways of the tribe? Do you even look the part? This hour, we're going to explore what it means to be American Indian in America today. If you are Native, what are the issues you face in terms of identity? How is it different from the stereotypes of yesterday and the stereotypes of today? We'll be taking questions from the audience here in the tent, but as always, we urge you to join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Patty Talahongva is a full-blooded Hopi from northeastern Arizona, producer of the public radio program Native America Calling. She joins us here in the Indigenous Broadcasting Tent on the Mall. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Neil.
You've got a few fans.
All my relatives.
As the producer and sometimes co-host of Native America Calling, we occasionally call it the Talk of the Nations. But you've dealt with a lot of issues of identity within the community many times. What are the major issues that face American Indians in this regard today?
Well, I think the biggest problem that we have is getting non-Native Americans to recognize that we have very distinct and unique tribal nations, and to understand that we prefer to be called by our tribal nations instead of American Indian or Native American or First Nations or whatever, because all of those are wrong. I have a lot of friends from India, and I always say, you're the real Indian, I'm the fake Indian, but I'm the real Hopi. So when you look at terms of identity, we always prefer to be referred to as Hopi or as Pima or as Lakota or whatever our tribe is. And that takes effort by non-Native people to really think about it, because non-Native America really does just lump us all together. Oh, you guys are all Indians. Oh, you do certain things all in the same way. When in actuality, we have our own languages, we have our own culture, our own traditions, and some of them, you know, we may have some similarities, but in actuality, we are very unique groups of people.
I understand you jokingly refer to yourself as a card-carrying Indian.
Yes, I have my card right here.
Who issues it?
The tribe. My tribe issues my card for a lot of our tribes here, and I brought this card with me today because that is a joke. You know, we are card-carrying Indians or non-card-carrying, or, you know, for some of us who don't have that federal recognition, you know, you have to show your descendancy. And there are some Native people who absolutely refuse to become a member of a tribe because, again, it's a government definition of who we are. But, we are card-carrying Indians. I don't know.
And what does the card say?
It has a really bad picture of me.
Well, it wouldn't be an official card without a bad picture.
Well, okay, right? that's a given, I guess. And just your name, you know, and your identity as how much degree of Hopi blood do I have? And it says 4/4 on my card. Mm-hmm. But there's another story behind that, because I'm actually 1/4 Tewa Indian and 3/4 Hopi, but the Tewas in our village and within our tribe were absorbed into the Hopi tribe, and so today, you can find a lot of Tewas living at Hopi, but we're identified on our enrollment cards as Hopi. And then on the back, it shows our clan. And that's also another identity. What clan are you? Because within a lot of our tribal communities, we have different clan systems. And a lot of times, you cannot marry somebody within your own clan. So for Hopi, I'm Corn Clan and Water Clan. Batkiwungwa and Puka'uwungwa. And also, my father was Spider Clan. So that gets, you know, takes a lot of people off the list of who could be your potential partner in life. But it's real important to identify clan, because once you find out if they're a clan member, then they become your family member, even though you've never may have met them before.
So you've got to feed them dinner, in other words.
Absolutely, and that's the Hopi way. You know, come over to my house and we'll feed you, no problem.
I'm interested, though, in that part of the identification by blood. How far does the fraction, how small does that fraction get? Does it go to 30 seconds, 64ths?
It depends, and it depends for every single tribe how they determine the blood quantum of their enrolled members. And it also goes to the cultural lineage. In Hopi, we are matriarchal, and we follow the mother's clan. So if your mother is Hopi, you're Hopi. No matter who your father is, no matter what culture or part of the world that person may have come from, you're Hopi. If your mother is Hopi, you're Hopi. And then you belong to the mother's clan. So it varies within tribes, and some tribes have had to look at lowering the amount of blood quantum in order to enroll a member for a lot of different reasons. You know, we have a small population, and getting people to marry within the native race is a challenge. We have a lot of people who are marrying outside their tribe and outside of the race, so you have to consider that.
And aren't there a fair number of tribes that would accept somebody who may not have any Indian blood whatsoever but lives the Indian way of life?
I'm not so certain about that. To be legally enrolled,
uh-huh.
No, I don't think so.
But to some degree, it's a self-identification, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But to be legally enrolled in a tribe, because the legal definition allows you then access to Indian health services and to educational benefits and that type of thing. So if you're not a member of a tribe, then you're not going to be able to take advantage of those benefits.
I see. And that might refer to this email question we got from Cindy in Norman, Oklahoma. I am of Scots, Irish, French, Choctaw, and Cherokee descent. So who am I, she asks.
Well, that's up to her to define. Because I think that's a very good question, because as Native people, again, in your introduction you talked about the divisions that we have within reservation Indians or urban Indians, people who know their culture, who don't. It depends on how you identify yourself and how comfortable you are with calling yourself either one of, maybe you're a member of four different tribes, you know, you have all this lineage in you, but who do you identify with the most and what do you know the most about? So that goes back to who you are and how comfortable you are in identifying yourself. And I would say I wouldn't let anybody identify me. You know, I'm a Hopi woman, I am an urban Indian, I'm a product of relocation in boarding school and a bunch of other stuff. But, you know, who am I? I'm Patty Thalahungava, and I'm Hopi.
Well, let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email to the regular address. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. And let's talk with Bobby. Bobby joins us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Bobby.
Hello, sir.
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. You know, you just alluded to the fact that what is an Indian and how do we think of ourselves as being Indians. I'm a tribal elder with the Eastern Shawnee tribe here in Oklahoma, and I want to tell you that being Indian is not a measure of one's blood. It's a matter of one's heart. And the blood that's in me, the Eastern Shawnee blood that flows in my veins, says forevermore, my children's children's children will be forever Shawnee. Thank you very much, sir.
I think you
have a terrific program. I listen to you daily.
Well, thanks very much for that, Bobby. We appreciate the phone call as well.
I think he brings up a really good point, too, because a lot of times Native people will look at each other and say, well, you may be full-blooded, but what kind of ties do you have to your community? What kind do you care about your community? Does your community recognize you? And if you can't answer that, you know, if you walk around, no matter if you're full-blood, what good is that if you don't care about what's happening with your people or with your Native people as a whole?
Does this get into the divisions between urban and res? Do people leave the res and leave the old ways behind?
I don't think they necessarily leave the old ways behind. And there may be challenges in trying to get back for ceremonies and things like that. But you don't leave it behind. You pray. Our spirituality is very much a part of our everyday life. How can you get back and be a part of those ceremonies is a different challenge. And how can you continue to raise your children in that way is a challenge. But I don't think we leave it behind. And for those, you know, there may be a few who do that. There are choices that they've had to make for a lot of different reasons.
Okay, let's take another phone call now. Annie joins us on the line from Naples in Florida. Annie, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi there. My question goes to almost precisely to what you were talking about in terms of identifying who is and who is not Indian, because I've been to an awful lot of powwows and roundups and what have you, and you see these people, the redheaded, freckle-faced so-and-sos who claim to be Indian, and this fellow is just saying it's what's in your heart, but then your guest says, you can't just choose to be Indian. Obviously, there's a race involved there aside from the culture, and I wonder how Indians who are tribal members feel in response to folks who have some questionable claim on membership, and who appear, at least from my outside view, as little more than like groupies who want to be a part of something. They feel connected to something, but they don't actually have any relationship to it. They just want to own it. Is that offensive?
Patty?
Well, I think definitely we will laugh about wannabes, people who want to be Indian. And, you know, granted, it's great being an Indian, you know, native person. I think that when you look at that, you know, there are going to be people who want to be Indians and such. But again, when you look at who you're identifying with and how you identify yourself and the ties that you have to your culture, that's who you are. And this whole idea of what do Indians look like, you know, don't even go there, because that's very dangerous. You know, and as far as judging who is an Indian, dark skin, black hair, long braids, whatever. No, you know, we have people who are very fair-skinned. We have people who have green eyes. We have people who are light-haired. For a lot, again, back to intermarriage and whatnot. But, you know, so what does an Indian look like? You know, again, if you can say, I can trace my lineage back, I have ties to my community, I know who I am, and I practice as much as I can, you know, it's back to self-identification. And it hurts me to think that, you know, when you go into a powwow circle, a place that's supposed to be sacred, and you're supposed to have come with a good heart and pray, or for any of the ceremonies, people are saying, oh, well, look, you know, they don't look Indian. Well, who's to say, you know? What would you say you look like?
Well, that's for other people to decide, but Irish is what I mostly look like. Anyway, those construction sounds you hear are, well, construction sounds. They're still setting up the First Americans Festival for tomorrow, so that's the sound in the background. We're broadcasting from a tent. Let's get a question from the mic here in the tent, and it's, I think, one of your co-workers, Patty. Go ahead, Wayne.
Uh-oh.
My question is, I'm full-blooded White Mountain Apache, but how often in a day are you confronted with the fact that you yourself are Hopi, and how do you reconcile that way of life with modern life? I get behind the steering wheel, and I touch that steering wheel. It's sacred to me because it's circular. It represents life. It holds my life in its hands. Or if an animal that is forbidden flies my windowsill during the day at work and I'm not supposed to see it, I get a little worried. I break out in a little bit of a sweat. Or I'm food I'm not supposed to eat during the day. How do you handle all that and still function in today's society? It's a struggle for me.
And how do you do it in 30 seconds?
Well, you keep your spirituality intact, and when you need to pray and when you need to take care of those situations that may come into your path, you take care of them, and that's where being grounded is, when you go back home or take some time to pray, because we do have those challenges in our lives.
Thank you. Patty Talahongva is a full-blooded Hopi, as we just heard, from the northeastern area of Arizona. She's producer of Native America Calling, and she's our guest here on Talk of the Nation today as we're discussing issues of Indian identity in relation with the opening of the National Museum of the American Indian here on the Mall in Washington, D.C. We'll have more of your calls, emails, and questions from the tent here after a short break. Give us a phone call if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send questions by email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're broadcasting today from a tent on the Mall here in Washington, D.C. Tomorrow, the National Museum of the American Indian opens. We're about a block and a half from the site. We're talking about what it means to be an American Indian or Native American or Indigenous Aboriginal or First Nation American today. Our guest is Patty Talahongva, the producer of the public radio program Native American Calling. Are you Native American? What are the issues you face being Native in the first 21st century? Of course, you're invited to join our conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Comedian Charlie Hill is a Native from Wisconsin's Oneida Nation. He's done stand-up on Letterman and Leno, was a staff writer for The Roseanne Show. Now in his 60s, he's become an icon in the Native community.
50s.
50s.
I'm in my 50s.
You're in your 50s.
Yeah. Yeah, come to the meetings, Neil.
It's an important distinction, isn't it? Yeah, right. So you get up there. Tomorrow, he hosts the festivities on the Mall to celebrate the opening of the National Museum of the American Indian, and he joins us here on the Mall. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation at whatever age
Thank
you are.
Thank you very much, Neil. Thank you.
Comedians tend to deal a lot with issues of identity. What have you learned over the years about what it means to be to an Indian, to be a Native, and what others think it means?
You know, to me, when someone asks me what it's like to be Indian, it's like asking somebody what's it like to breathe. You know, 500 years, we've always been asked the same questions where nobody comes up to you and say, how do you feel being Caucasian? Do you talky-hunky? How do you survive in these suburbs, you know? Or if I go to this audience here, one little, two little, three little whiteies. Ooh, it got quiet in here, didn't it? You know, so it's like 500 years, people are still studying us, and we've been right in your face here. And I think if Americans see us through such a myopic way, how can they not see their sciences, religions, and culture the same way? We've been right in their face all this time, and they're still asking us these questions. And you could have had it all if you'd asked us the first day. But all this tragedy wouldn't have happened to us if we'd only strip-searched those pilgrims. It would have been a little different right there.
It was the box cutters that did you in.
Yeah. We didn't know those muskets were weapons of mass destruction. See, that's what happened.
That was the blankets, I think, was the problem.
Yeah, yeah, that was the follow-up, bro.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of old stereotypes as well. I mean, one of the things a lot of people may expect to see when they walk in that museum in the next couple of days is a picture of Tonto.
Is there one in there?
I don't think so, no.
Well, there was Tonto, Harpo, Chico, and Groucho. See, he was the adopted one. Not many people know about that. And Macho, that was another one.
Well, there's the other, the Tonto stereotype, also the famous spot of the noble Indian crying for for the environment in the anti-pollution commercial.
Yeah, and by the way, that was Indians throwing garbage at his feet because the guy, it was a bad commercial.
Let's get another caller on the line. Alicia is with us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Yes.
Alicia, you're on the air.
Yeah. Oh, hi. My question is about identity. My dad was 8th Indian. He's from a Homa tribe. And my mother was Cherokee, 16th.
Hello? Yes, we're having a little trouble hearing you.
Okay.
Are you
okay,
behind
I'm
the
sorry.
Tent or on the phone?
Hi. Anyway, so my question is, my lineage on my mother's side, I actually have, my great-great-grandmother gave me some wooden beads before she died, and I still have them. And my question is, you know, I feel like I'm in limbo. I'm aware that I'm the survivor of one of the worst Holocausts that ever took place, and I don't understand where I fit in. I don't feel like I fit into mainstream American culture, even though I was raised that way. I've never felt like I fit in. And yet I'm afraid that I don't fit into Native American culture because I look white, and I grew up as a white person, and it's awkward to try to connect with tribes that I'm not even sure. So, you know, how would I figure that, you know, can you give me some advice on how to figure that out, or would I be welcomed even though I'm so diverse and watered down?
I don't know, Charlie, if you want to answer that, or Patty.
I would just say go back where your people are from, and if you're really from there, they would know who you are. It's simple as that. If people don't practice their culture, religion, or enroll with the tribe, I say game over. And if you really are that and it's been taken away from you, find out who your relatives are, then go back home. And if it rings true, you'll find out who you are.
Patty, would you agree with that?
I think in trying to find your tribe and who they are, the part of the problem is a lot of the families denied their native roots for so long. And that poses a problem for their their descendants, because they can't find their grandfather. Their people are no longer alive to ask them these questions. But somewhere in the background, just keep looking. It takes effort, but if you really want to connect and you really want to find out who your people are, then you have to dig and you have to figure out through tribal enrollment forms or whatever to try to locate who your people are. And my heart goes out to some people like that because, you know, again, I'm fortunate. I know who I am, but there's a lot of people out there who not just families didn't talk about it, but also maybe have been adopted out before the Indian Child Welfare Act came around. So they were lost.
Also, a lot of people are claiming now because we got casinos. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, some tribes yeah. have casinos.
Like some your of them, tribe, you're right, you're
you
right.
have a casino.
Right.
See, my tribe voted down twice against gaming,
mm-hmm.
so we don't have a casino.
Which way did you vote? Go ahead, Alicia. I'm sorry.
My dad was very hesitant to tell me for a long time. He actually lied that he was Indian and tried to tell me he was Spanish. He grew up in the last of the boarding schools. Was taken from his parents and had very difficult times. And when I asked him why he never taught me, he said, "I never wanted you to suffer the way that I suffered. I suffered my whole life because I was Indian." He grew up in the South, and in the South, Indians were treated worse than blacks before civil rights. So he had to sit with the black people. He had to ride with the black people in the back of the bus and drink from the colored fountains, and all of that pain for him. You know, he thought he was doing me a favor.
Well, they also kept good records, too, and a lot of the missionaries kept good records, too. So, again, go back and track that down, track that information down.
But the story, and good luck to you, but the story she tells is a very sad and awful story of what happened to the Indians who went to a lot of the schools that were established so far away from their homes.
I had a friend who was proud of his heritage. He said he was African-American and Native American. And I thought, this poor guy that only stole his land and made him work on it for free. Also, I think the word Native American, we don't call each other that. We are older than America. So how can we be Native of something we are older than? The Canadians, the Native part we are, but we are older than America. And at this particular time in history, America is, everybody around the world is pretty pissed off at America. So I just want to say to people around the world, we are sovereign people. We have nothing to do with this.
Here's an email question from Marlene Webster in South Dakota. What does it mean when you talk of the seven nations? Patty?
The seven nations or the seven generations?
Well, the question has to be about seven nations, but I know there are six nations. To help us out with the numbers here.
Okay, I think maybe she's referring to, because I've not heard of seven nations, except the Iroquois nations.
They
changed
it this morning.
Oh, they changed it? Wait, I missed the memo. I'm sorry. Okay.
They go to seven.
Seven.
Seven generations.
Seven generations.
Yeah. I thought you were all on the same email list, you know.
Well, you know, that goes to the divisions of, you know, all the different tribes in the country, large land-based tribes, small land-based tribes, you know, whatever. It can go, the identity can go in many different directions. I think what she's referring to is the idea of seven generations. When you make a decision, when you look at making a decision, you have to think very hard and long about what your decision will mean to not just this generation or next generation or the following generation, but seven generations down the road. How is this going to impact those people? And if it's not going to be a good impact for the people in seven generations from now, it's not a good decision, and maybe you better not make that decision.
We're going to ask Patty Talahongva and Charlie Hill to stay with us, but let's introduce a new character now. Paloma Hill, or should I say, Polona Edwina Villanueva Hill, is here with us in the broadcasting tent on the Mall. Nice of you to join us on Talk of the Nation today.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Now, you're an example of the next generation, half Mohawk, half Cayuga, a quarter Filipino, and a quarter Hispanic. That adds up to one and a half of you, I think.
Right. Well, that half is half Cayuga and half Mohawk. I'm actually Mohawk, but on my card it says that I'm upper Cayuga because they messed up a little bit. On the Canadian side, we had this bill called Bill C-31. It took some people off the scrolls and then put them back on a little while later at the wrong tribe, so that's what happened.
So you are 20 years old. You are Canadian and American.
Mm-hmm.
You've lived on the res and in the city. You now attend Stanford University. Any identity problems at all?
Just a couple. You know, I've been everywhere, and it seems like everywhere I go, I confront some problems with my identity. when I first moved on the res, I barely even knew that I was Indian, you know? But I was there 4th, 5th, and 6th grade, and I got to learn a whole lot about my culture, and so I carried that back with me when I went back to California. And I just decided to look into that, you know, in university and stuff. So I study a lot of my culture now. I go back home. I work with Native issues today.
And you call what home?
Well, that's hard because my mom lives in California and my dad lives he lives up north in Fort Erie. So I don't really know where home is right now.
Do you, in your various incarnations, encounter racism?
Yeah, I do, actually. When I was in high school, my brother and I were the only natives, really, in our high school, except for another counselor woman, an older woman, who tried to help us start a native group. But in high school, you know, my friends, well, they were my friends. They used to call me Paloma Hontis and, you know, ask me if I lived in a teepee. A lot of people don't really know that we do still exist, you know, as people. They think we just live on reservations and we're a dying culture, you know, the whole Tonto phenomenon. It's kind of really sad and heart-wrenching.
What problems, if any, did you encounter when you went back to the res?
Going back to the res now, it's a little bit different. You know, you're an educated person. You're not living that res life that a lot of people are forced to just stay inside. And I think a lot of times people do leave the res and they don't come back, which is a sad thing. So I just try to be close to my family when I'm home and, you know, let them know that I'm still there. I still fight for Indian rights. That's what I want to do with my life.
Fight for Indian rights? Professionally, that's what you want to do?
Yeah, pretty much. I want to be a native lawyer, you know, help keep our sovereignty, make sure that it's alive and well and nobody's infringing upon it, you know, get back some land or something.
As you look at yourself, what do you think makes you more native? Is it blood? Is it culture? Is it language? Do you speak the language?
No, I don't speak the language, actually. There's not very many people on our reserve that still speak the language. A lot of elders do. I don't really know what it is. It's a feeling. It's the blood. It's a whole mixture of things, you know.
There are a lot of disparities in terms of economic opportunities. You have things available to you that a lot of people, other people, don't. Is this characteristic of your generation? Is this characteristic of the way your parents lived?
No, I think it's characteristic of the generation, you know. Governments feel as if they owe Native people something, and I feel like they do. And I feel like our generation is really flourishing with a lot of the programs that they have for younger Native people.
We're talking about Indian identity today, one day before the official opening of the Smithsonian Institution's new National Museum of the American Indian on the Mall here in Washington, D.C. We're broadcasting live, so if you hear an occasional truck backing up or some people hammering metal, that's what the sound is. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we have somebody at the microphone here in the tent. Go ahead, sir. Tell us your name and go ahead with your comment or your question.
My name is W.J. Strickland, a member of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina. Of course, many people have never heard of us. We were here, as Mr. Hill has indicated, you know, before the 13 original colonies. And I've had the fortune or misfortune of being in Washington, D.C. for some 30-plus years. I'm not quite back as far as you, Charlie, and in those I won't reveal my age, but and I have dealt with racism throughout my, you know, professional career as well as growing up, because we were not Indian by the dominant society, and
the federal government does not recognize the Lumbee as a tribe.
That's correct. We have to. Well, that's a whole nother broadcast. We don't want to go
there.
Indeed
it is, yes.
But, you know, this whole question of identity, and, of course, here I am in my apron and my hat, and I do native food. And, of course, the question is, what is native food? What is tradition? What is the culture that goes with that? Because we are here as a part of the of this event to celebrate this event and to serve Native food. And we've been asked these questions, and we've been trying to respond. But I have to tell you that the way these questions are being framed, it tingles the racisms all over again, because when you grow up with it, you know it when you hear it and when you see it. And so I think this whole business of identity is still amongst us. It's still prevalent, very much prevalent. And I want to applaud the fact that this panel is making its presentation today, and we have this fine audience here that will be listening and partaking of that, because my experience has been I've dealt with it one-on-one in my time to and people have opened up their hearts and their minds, and they've accepted me and recognized me as a Native American. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that statement. Interesting. We're going to be talking a lot more about food when we come back on the other side of the break. But Paloma Hill, before we let you go, I did want to ask, speaking of some of the legal issues you're talking about, you're interning right now at the Department of Justice's Office of Tribal Justice. What are you learning there about issues of tribal identity and the Lumbee? And I'm afraid we just have a minute and a half, but go ahead.
I just finished my last day at the Office of Tribal Justice.
And oh, so you're free to talk now.
Yes, I am. Well, I just learned a lot about tribes and their relationship with the federal government. A lot of the problems with the justice systems that tribes have, you know, because they're just trying to set up their governments now, realizing self-determination, trying to be self-sustaining. And so we try to help them a little bit with whatever we can in doing those things.
Yeah, sovereignty, a subject we most often associate with the issue of Iraq, obviously gone on a little longer here in your subject area.
Definitely.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us today. Good
Thank
luck.
You.
Paloma Hill is an American Indian, a senior at Stanford University, now in Washington, just wrapping up her internship at the Department of Justice's Office of Tribal Justice. You're listening to Talk of the Nation. We're doing a live broadcast today from the museum, the opening tomorrow of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian. It's on the Mall here in Washington, D.C., the latest and last edition to the fine collection of museums that surround this particular patch of greensward in the nation's capital that's often been referred to as the nation's front lawn. We'll have more after a short break. We invite you to join us. We're talking about issues of American Indian identity. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, TOTN at NPR.org. Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting live on the National Mall here in Washington, D.C. As you can hear, there's a few people here in the tent with me. A lot of activities going on in the background in preparation for tomorrow's opening of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, families of children with mental illness, the challenging task of balancing medical treatment with difficult tasks of growing up. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Tune in at this time tomorrow for that. Today, we're talking about Native, Indigenous, Aboriginal, First Nation, or American Indian identity today. Our guests are Patty Talahongva, a member of the Hopi Nation, producer of the public radio program Native America Calling, and comedian Charlie Hill. And they are both here with us in the tent. We're accepting calls from you at 800-989-8255. Email TOTN. At NPR.org. We also have a microphone open here in the tent, and let's get another question from the audience here.
Hi, my name is Bill Havens, and I'm from Arizona. And I have more of a comment, I think. There was a reference to racism, you know, and that issue. And I think that from what I've observed, you know, racism almost 100% of the time evolves out of ignorance. And the museum is going to be one way to help eliminate some of that ignorance by educating the people about Native people. And so, you know, this is a big step, I think.
It also reinforces it.
Charlie Hill, go ahead. I'm sorry.
It also reinforces it because people will think of us in terms of the past. So it does both things.
Okay. I haven't seen the displays yet, so I don't know how much it emphasizes the past or the future. But
Patty, did you want to get in on this?
Yes, they actually have a whole exhibit there called Our Peoples, I believe. And we were able to go into the museum on Saturday for a sneak preview. And they show Native people today who we are and what we look like and the different aspects that we're involved in society today, because we're everywhere. We're in every single state. We're in all sorts of professions, and we're living and breathing right next to you, and that's part of the exhibit. Is you could be walking down the street and walking right next to a Native American and not even know it.
That is one of the curiosities of people sometimes on vacation go out west to, see the Indians.
And that always makes me laugh because I live in New Mexico now, but I just recently moved from Arizona. And when tourists would come to Arizona and say that, I would say, well, where are you from? And they would say, New York. Well, guess what? There are Native people right there all over New York, and actually in Manhattan, in that area there. So, and not just urban Indians, but tribal people as well. So we're everywhere. We are absolutely everywhere because this is our homeland.
Since the museum isn't open yet, let me ask a dumb white guy question, since I've not been educated as yet. How do you address an American Indian, somebody you don't know? Is it do you call them Native American? What do you call, just in terms of being a dumb white guy?
Ask them what tribe, what nation they're from. Most Indian people, I can find an Indian person I've never met, within 10 minutes we know somebody that's in common. Because that's how unique and small our world is, and we kind of know each other in that way.
We know all Indians, right?
Yeah, that's the other stereotype. We know all Indian people. Yeah, that's it.
But we do.
Yeah.
We really do.
Yeah.
That's like, so if somebody's an American Indian, you run into, say, oh, I know so-and-so, take them a message when you get back home.
Yeah.
We have another questioner here in the tent. Go ahead, just tell us your name, and go ahead.
I'm Jan Tucker, and I'd like to know, what you think the impact of stereotyping Native Americans in sport as sports mascots and in the media, what impact that has on today's American Indian youth identity and all of American Indian people?
Mm-hmm. I think it's nothing but blatant racism, simple as that. And in the nation's capital, we're called Redskins. You know, we're called Redskins in the nation's capital. I heard the government's going to make some kind of a phony apology while we're here, but yet we're mascots to this day. We're dehumanized. When Indians aren't human anymore, then you can do anything you want to them. A lot of, like Stanford, the girl from Stanford, mm-hmm. They're the Cardinals now. A lot of institutes of higher education are dropping that mascot. So I think if people change this, even the ones that hate it, there'll be a dialogue and there'll be a metaphysical shift in this country. In the Declaration of Independence, it says savage Indians in there three different times to this day. And if you talk to Bush about that, he'd probably change it to savage Native Americans. So I think the image of Indian people in America is nothing short of slanderous. People make fun of the way we talk, laugh, our names, what we do and everything. So here we are trying to elevate consciousness. And it's all there, just coming a good way, and there it is.
I agree. The issue of mascots is just, it boggles my mind that we still have this issue today. And I'm the immediate past president of the Native American Journalist Association, and Nadja called on the media to stop using these racist words and images. Because you can still tell a story in whether it's in radio or print or television without using these racist words and images. And unfortunately, the media, mainstream establishment media, did not answer that call very well. Print was more inclined to do away with mascot names and such, but not broadcast. And again, it boggles my mind. It hurts me when I see a young person, a young Native person, wearing a Redskins or some other mascot T-shirt or cap or whatever, because that plants an idea in their head and into non-Native people's heads that it's okay to make fun of Native people. It's okay to characterize them in this way with big nose and, you know, reddish face or whatever, you know. It's not okay. You know, we did away with stereotypes with Asian people. We did away with stereotypes with black people and with Latinos. But what's up with Native Americans? Why can't we do away with that? It's not, I don't want to say it's an emotional issue. It's a practical issue, and it's not, what's the other term they always tell us? Oh, you know, you're so sensitive or whatever. Oh,
they're
and
honoring
us.
Don't honor us. Respect us.
Yeah, don't honor us in that way. Just respect us as human beings.
And then the stock answer is, well, there's a Notre Dame fighting Irish. Well, the Irish determined this, but how would they feel it was a Notre Dame drunken Irish? It's a different kind of deal there.
That's the other thing, you know, that's a whole other show. Maybe we can do that on just the mascot issue. But again, in terms of identity, a lot of our kids, you know, just getting them to acknowledge their native people and to be proud of who they are, you know, without having all their classmates walking around saying things, doing things, whatever, that knocks that image down, that knocks that self-esteem down. How do we build that up? And we fight a lot with as native parents against all this outside influence with our children and how we raise them to be proud and healthy and happy native kids.
One aspect that this new National Museum, the American Indian, will address is the issue of food. If the saying, you are what you eat, is true, then talking about the food of a people fits in with our discussion of identity. One of the pleasures of exploring the new museum, which opens tomorrow, is the cafe. Instead of hot dogs, they have hot tamales from South America. Burgers aren't just hamburgers, but campfire buffalo burgers from the Great Plains. There won't be a pizza in sight, but you'll find pumpkin fry bread and chicken, beef, or pork totopos from Mesoamerica. And let's not forget the cedar plank juniper salmon from the Northwest Coast. Food can tell us a lot about a people or a culture. We're going to be joined now by Loretta Barrett Oden. She's native chef and native food historian. Unfortunately, she couldn't be with us here in Washington on the Mall. She's with us from the studios of radio station KATT in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bourgeois. Hello to Rick and Donna and Charlie. I wish I could be there with all my brothers and sisters.
Tell us a little bit about how, obviously, food is important to everybody. We all got to eat. Is it special for Native peoples?
Oh, most special. You know, if you look at cuisine, if you look at food, you know, there would be no culture without the acquisition and the preparation of food. So in order to get to know people better, the best thing you can do is share a meal with them. The vastness of the North America, this is how I really got started in this food, was I figured to study the indigenous foods of the Americas and to use that huge diversity of foods to point out how diverse are we as Indian people. So to travel across the country and down into Mexico and Central America, and you look at how different the foods are. The foods are based on what was and is available in those areas. There are very, very distinct cuisines available from places like the Northwest Coast, the deserts of the Southwest, and it is very much an identity issue with our people.
We're speaking with Loretta Barrett Oden, a native chef and native food historian, in our discussion of American Indian identity. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Loretta Barrett Oden, let me ask you a little bit about the role of food. We heard a little bit earlier from Patty Talahongva and others about the diversity of Indian peoples. Obviously, there's all kinds of different, there's not one Indian food, in other words.
Oh, absolutely not. I think probably the only thing that, and of course you ask anyone, be they Indian or white, what is Indian food? Well, it's fried bread, Navajo tacos and Indian tacos, and that is such, you know, that is a bit of a myth, because the bounty that Mother Earth provided for us and still provides for us in the Americas, you know, fully 60% to 70% of the foods enjoyed around the world today originated in the Americas, in this hemisphere. Everything from tomatoes, potatoes, corn, beans, squash, even chocolate, and those products, those foods left these shores and traveled around the world and had, you know, some very interesting impacts on the cuisines and even population migrations. And they come back to America as things like Irish potatoes, Belgian or Swiss chocolate. And this food history is so keen, it's so wonderful, and it is a way of really pointing out how diverse are our people. We are not just all Indians.
Charlie Hill, let me ask you, is there one, there's probably no more powerful sense that human beings possess than the sense of smell. Is there, when you go home, is there one smell cooking that tells you you're home?
Yeah. Corn soup. That reminds me that I'm home. And also, I think it was my dad told me 5/8 of the world's food came from Indian people. And if we didn't give the potatoes to the Irish, what would they have starved from?
Well, we thank you for that. Patty Talahongva, let me ask you the same question. Is there one smell that tells you you're home?
I think more it's the wood that burns, and then you know the food is cooking.
Yeah.
What's going to be there when you walk in that door, or what you're expected to cook, you know, the case may be. But we have corn. Corn is our everyday staple food, and we cook it in many, many different ways. And it's also sacred to us because we use it to pray as well. And our food, it takes a lot of time to prepare. It's not just you walk in there and microwave this stuff. You know, you really have to work hard. And we have a sweet pudding that we bake in the ground overnight. And someone has to tend to that fire and make sure that that pudding is cooked. So a lot of really good food there.
Mm-hmm.
Beaky. Our bread that's paper thin and rolled up. It's beautiful. Great taste.
Loretta Barrett-Oden, I'm going to give you the last minute.
Okay. Well, food, like I said before, it is central to every culture. And my theory has been that in order to heighten people's awareness, if I can just feed them a good meal and then catch them, it's a matter of grabbing them by their bellies. And really, they will listen then to most anything you have to say. Along with the food comes the agricultural practices, the taking care of Mother Earth, thanking the spirits of all of the animals, the plants, the mm-hmm. grasses, everything that grows, and giving thanks for that. You know, we Indian people are the caretakers of the earth, and if we don't give thanks and really start taking better care of Mother Earth, I fear that one day she will just shrug her shoulders and say, enough of these little pesky critters on me, let's get rid of them.
Loretta Barrett-Oden, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Yes.
Loretta Barrett-Oden is joined us from the studios at commercial station KATT in Oklahoma City. And let me thank our other guests, Patty Talahongva, producer of the public radio program Native America Calling. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
And comedian Charlie Hill also joined us. Thanks to him as well. We'd like to thank some of the other people who made this possible. That includes our technical director, Kevin Waite. He had help from Johnny Vince Evans. We'd also like to thank the staff of the radio program Native America Calling for their generosity and support through this process. Susan Brain, Patty Talahongva, John Jahati, Nola Davies Moses, and Wayne Cody. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation. We're broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. This is NPR News.